Hi.
Hi, Adam.
I got this.
We got disconnected. That's okay. We're back on track. You can just continue. We were talking about the neurologist and that their level of involvement. We were also, I do remember when you first contacted me, I was also surprised at that stage. Your dad might have been in ICU for about 4 weeks, I believe, when you first contacted me. And one of the first questions that I had for you was, why does he not have a tracheostomy or a trach? Can you share more about, you know, what was discussed then with the ICU team in terms of tracheostomy? And what I would also like to share with our listener really is, you know, best practice normally for a tracheostomy is after about 10 days to 14 days of ventilation with a breathing tube. If somebody can't come off the ventilator, then a tracheostomy should be performed to ease the burden of ventilation. And as I said, I do believe when you first contacted me, your dad had already been in ICU for about 3 or 4 weeks. Can you share more about what discussions you've had with the ICU about tracheostomy and what your point of view was at the time?
Yeah, sure. So from what I've read and my own research, a tracheostomy is a more comfortable breathing tube. It is something that should have been done quite straight away. One of the reasons that they couldn't do one for my father is because they said he had a short neck. My father's anatomy is, maybe you could say, slightly higher, bigger than sort of average person. And in doing so, this may have been a, you know, complicated procedure. From my understanding, that this was not done because it was something that just couldn't be done in the ICU ward. It would have been done under surgery. Now, why they couldn't do it under surgery at the time, I didn't know. But what I was told was they didn't see the point in doing so at the time, because they didn't feel as if my father was going to make a recovery. In the UK, clinicians, doctors, surgeons cannot carry out anything or treat the patient with anything where they feel as if there's not going to be a benefit
to
the patient. And in this case, in doing so for my father, there would have been no benefit in him having a tracheostomy, because as far as they were concerned, my father wasn't going to recover anymore.
Right. And how did you feel about that, you know, how did you feel about that at the time? Was that something you could, you and your family could accept easily? How were you dealing with that level of frustration at the time?
I mean, I was quite disappointed. I was very disappointed, because as time went on, you know, my research, and I'd been you know, reading into this quite a bit, and I was very disappointed, because the tracheostomy would have allowed my father to be moved to a ward where they could have given him the chance to recover, where they could have potentially sat him up, stimulate him a bit more. Under the breathing tube that he came in and they put in which goes down through his mouth into his throat, that doesn't allow him to do anything. That just keeps him at intensive care. So for me, it was very frustrating, because they couldn't do this procedure because their guidelines don't allow them to carry out a procedure on someone they don't see the benefit. But as far as I was concerned, it was too soon to say that this, too soon to say whether it was going to be like this permanently.
Yeah.
So I did see the point in doing so. In fact, one of the battles that we had with them, and this is one of the things that you helped me with in terms of the preparation for the meetings. Because, you know, I've done a bit of research myself, and from speaking to yourself, it gave me more of a clearer understanding on the reasons why a tracheostomy would be beneficial for my father.
Yeah.
And this really helped me when I went into the meeting with them to discuss this. Because the doctors and the clinicians won't lie, but it must feel like they won't sort of, you know, give you scenarios of where someone may have had something like this done and went on to survive. So, you know, and at that point, you know, that's when talking with yourself, Patrick, really helped me really, you know, ask them the right questions, and sometimes they don't have an answer for those questions. And I do believe that the 100 days my father was in ICU really allowed me and my family some closure and more acceptance, because in the end, you know, my father remained in a vegetative state. However, it gave us time to accept that this is now, and you know, there's no 100% certainty, but this is now as good as it may well get. And in that time, you know, he was seen by various experts that we had requested, and that helps us as well. That helps us with giving us closure, because within 2 weeks, we didn't accept that my father had brain damage like this permanently. And the brain is such a thing that there's no 100% certainty. There's cases of people have had a cardiac arrest and died straight away. But in my father's case, we were seeing small signs of changes, and for us, you know, this was heading in the right direction. But eventually it got to a point where we didn't see any more progress, and we'd been there for over 3 months to really give us some closure and give us some more certainty as to what his quality of life would have been in the future. But had it not been for us challenging the intensive care doctors and asking for that extra time, I really feel as if, you know, we would have maybe fallen to the pressure of switching the machine off very far too soon, and then having to live the rest of our lives thinking to ourselves, what if I had done this, or what if we had said no. This is something that I certainly don't regret doing. With your help, Patrick, and you really helped us prepare for these meetings and gave us your experience of being in intensive care for many years on what is acceptable and what they can potentially do that they may not have been doing. And that really helped us. I really believe that that helped us buy time with my father in intensive care.
And that was time you and your family really needed, as you've hinted towards, to come to terms with things. I really believe you left no stone unturned. And, you know, in the end, no matter how hard it is, but in the end, I believe you and your family were able to accept it. You know, that's the way it is, and you could accept that your father eventually passed away. Let me ask you a question. Many listeners might ask, oh, you know, you've gone through 100 days in intensive care until your father passed away, and many listeners might think, oh, was there a lot of suffering? You know, would it have been better for your dad to potentially die earlier and limit the suffering? Can you comment on that? Do you think your dad was suffering?
So at the start, I didn't really know. But as time went on and speaking to the doctors, doing my own research, speaking to yourself, I was under the understanding that my father's not aware of himself or his surroundings. And, you know, if there was suffering, I do believe that, you know, he was suffering for the right to live. Because potentially it was far too soon to say, oh, my father's suffering, let's switch off the life support. For me, certainly in my father's point of view, that would not have been acceptable. It did go through my head that, you know, maybe my father's suffering. But in the end, I believe that he may have a chance to live.
Absolutely.
So a little bit of suffering. But when we got to the end, it was my understanding and my belief that he didn't actually feel anything. And he wasn't suffering. So that almost, in a way, helped us as well with regards to, you know, feeling less regret, because this was a very tough decision to make.
Absolutely.
My father, at the end of the 104 days in total, at the end of that, he was, his eyes were wide open, and his eyes were fixed into, you know, a particular direction, but he wasn't aware of what was going on. And that made it harder, in a sense, to make that decision.
Yeah.
But it gave me, me and my family, it gave us closure, and I feel as if we were almost as close to certain as we could be. This is now permanent. On many occasions, the doctors had said that my father wouldn't even get to this stage. As time went on, I was doubting them even more. At one point, the doctor said your father was going to open his eyes, and, you know, a few weeks later, he opened his eyes. So, you know, when I sort of saw this progress in my dad, and what the doctors had said, it made me raise more questions. Maybe more questions about every single point. And that was every single point that, you know, we made sure that was looked at. And we had various conversations with yourself, Patrick, who helped us in, you know, different parts of my dad's progress. Each time we had that meeting, it was, we could go in there having knowledge, and that was the best thing, because then the doctors had known, done our research, and they knew as well that they could only sort of base it on their experience and say, well, we've seen this, and people don't have a quality of life. But then those people that did recover or were moved on in this state, you know, maybe question how many of these intensive care specialists do go on to see if that person has lived on and recovered. I'm not sure.
I'm pretty sure I mentioned that in our conversations that, you know, most intensive care doctors and nurses, they know everything about intensive care, but very rarely do they follow up with patients outside of intensive care once they leave intensive care alive. They have no idea what a patient's life looks like 6 weeks, 6 months, even 6 years down the line. You know, there's very little research there. There was a final sort of thought that I had, and there was a final issue that we spoke about, you know, really in the last few days of your dad's life, and I remember that quite clearly. One of your concerns at the time was the way your dad was approaching his end of life, and we discussed the issue of euthanasia a fair bit, because that was very important for you, that your dad would die a natural death, which he died a natural death in the end, from what I understand. Why was that so important to you? And where I'm going with this is really a lot of families in intensive care, when it comes to end of life, they actually don't know that sometimes death is hastened when life support is withdrawn, and then medications like morphine or midazolam are given and slow down breathing, and then patients often pass away because they have sedatives on board and they basically stop breathing. Now, that was really an important point at the time for you and your family to have nature take its course. Can you elaborate on why that was so important for you?
Yeah, sure. Just before the removal of the breathing tube for my father, me and my family sat down with the intensive care doctors and we discussed at what point they will remove the breathing tube and what's likely to occur after they remove the breathing tube. But we also discussed that if my father was to live on, because the breathing tube was assisting him in a small way. I can't remember the technical term, but it was a small percentage. Most of the breathing was done by himself.
Right.
So the doctors were mixed views. Some said he would die instantly. Some said that he would live on. It could be days, weeks, months even. But it was important that if my father did live on, what sort of care would my father be given? And what would happen in the case of he had started to show a sign of recovery and wakefulness or consciousness. So all these things were discussed. And after my father's breathing tube was removed, he continued breathing by himself, which he then, at that point, a couple of days after, he was moved on to a general ward.
Yeah.
In that general ward, he was seen by a different team completely. It was a care team, which was dealing with end of life.
Yeah.
And I had a couple of meetings with them as well about what level of care to provide to my father now, because it was accepted by all of that, this is my dad's sort of end of life now. In a few days after removing the tube, his breathing had been quite difficult for him. He could almost hear it.
Yeah.
And it was very important for me and my family that if my father was going to pass away, it would be very natural.
Mm-hmm.
He would just naturally pass away. So it was important for us that he was being kept hydrated.
Yeah.
And he was being kept fed through a feeding tube.
Yeah.
Because for me, that's not really, in my opinion, certainly it would have been part of our family values and certainly my father's, that this is your basic, these are your basic necessities, food and water. To be continued up until the end of life. And we'd all agreed that any other interventions wouldn't be made if there was any significant or a failure to a particular organ, then that would not be treated.
Yeah.
But the withdrawal of food, hydration, was important that was not removed. And my dad would eventually pass away slowly, but in a dignified way as well. That's exactly what occurred, but it got to a point where my father lived on a further week after the removal of the tube.
Yeah.
But it got to a point where within 4 days the doctors wanted to introduce the sedative again.
Yeah.
Because they thought it would make my father more comfortable. In our opinion, I didn't want him to be sedated because from what I understood from what I read, that potentially that would slow his organs down, and for me that wasn't anything very natural. I wanted him to pass away naturally and peacefully.
Yeah. Yeah.
One hand that if he wasn't aware of himself or surroundings. And on the other hand, they want to make him feel comfortable. So I didn't quite understand the thought process behind that.
Right. I mean, one might argue, and then it's certainly my experience, you felt under pressure from the start to withdraw treatment, even in the end, then you felt under pressure. They wanted to introduce the sedative. You know, one thing that I always argue is, you know, they want to limit the resources. They want to free up their beds. You know, it's very sad, but I'm really pleased knowing your story that you've stood your ground to the end and, you know, you basically had as much of an end of life situation on your terms as possible, you know, as much as the situation allowed. And can I just ask, you know, it's always hard to, you know, I don't even want to use the word success, you know, it's not a term that fits the situation. I can't come up with a better term at the moment, you know, but it has been very important for you and your family to leave no stone unturned and give your dad the best chance of survival, and you've done all of that, and I would assume that it has given you and your family some peace of mind to know that you've done everything within your power, you know, to give him the best chance. Was that, you know, can you look back at least and can you say, look, we've got some peace of mind around this situation?
Yeah, absolutely, Patrick. I told you, because for me and my family, when we sat down and talked about this, you know, on a daily basis, we wanted to ensure that the decision regarding the end of my life, end of my father's life, is made by what my father would have wanted, and we were representing my father's wishes. It wasn't made, or it wasn't pressured by anyone else.
Yeah.
From a doctor. And that, as you said, that gave me a little bit, in fact, quite a lot of peace of mind in the family, knowing that we had not left any stone unturned. And we had explored every single avenue up to the point where the expert's opinion that had eventually come in was someone that is of the highest degree of that particular field, the expert in that field of the disorder of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that gave us peace, knowing that we had explored everything. We'd done it on our terms. And he gave my father the fighting chance.
Yeah.
Because right now, you know, it's devastating what happened for me and my family. But we take a little comfort in knowing that it wasn't the fact that it happened. Obviously, it was out of our hands. But the whole process throughout was very, very involved with every single decision. And it gave us a little comfort knowing that we'd made those decisions, and that was the best and only the best decision for my father. No other agenda. And like you said, it wasn't about bed space for us. It wasn't about probability of survival for us. It was pure, this is what's best for my father, and this is what we think is the best, you know, for him in terms of giving him a chance, and that's what we wanted. We wanted time, wanted to give him a chance, because we'd heard stories about people surviving, we'd read, and you know, they were quite small, but we got to the point where we were absolutely a certainty in our hearts that this, you know, now it's so in that it gives us a bit of comfort, knowing that, and it gave us closure as well, knowing that we didn't leave any stones.
And what would you recommend? We have so many families coming to us at intensivecarehotline.com who are in a similar situation. They feel under pressure. They feel like, you know, or the doctors have asked us to agree to stop treatment. What would your advice be to families, to other families who are in a similar situation?
My advice would be not to just be pressured by the doctors or the treating team, not to feel as if their word is the final word. if it's a matter of opinion, it's an opinion, it's called an opinion for a reason. Go and look for another opinion. Go and do your own research. Go and question the doctors. It's quite daunting to go into a meeting room with people that are completely qualified and have done this for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And you, this is something very new to you, because you almost feel scared to ask them questions back. Or you almost maybe get the impression that, you know, their opinion is the final opinion. And trust me, it's certainly not. There have been doctors in the past that have been, in my reading, but not knowing anyone, but from what I've researched, there have been doctors that have been proven wrong and have got it wrong. And I just wanted to make sure that my father's case, he wasn't one of those cases where the doctor has got it wrong. So don't feel pressured. Prepare before you go into these meetings and go fully armed with all the knowledge, so that you can't be intimidated in a way where you're pressured to make decisions that you may well regret in the future. That was very important to me.
Yeah, and it is very important, because at the end of the day, they are life or death decisions, and you can't afford to get those decisions wrong. They're a once-in-a-lifetime situation, once-in-a-lifetime decisions you have to make. And we certainly see it all the time. The minute you start educating yourself, the minute we educate clients about their rights as well, which is very important. You've got to be aware of your rights in situations like that. You know, and you've certainly exercised all your rights in terms of giving your father the best chance of life. Adam, I'm conscious of your time, obviously, and I'm conscious of our listeners' time. Was there anything else you would like to add to the whole situation before we close off this interview?
No, not really. I think we've covered most things. You know, again, I just want to, I haven't thanked you enough, Patrick, but I'd just like to say thank you as a person that has really helped me and my family. One of the reasons, you know, I agreed to go on and help you with this podcast is because I do feel as if you do add true value into something that was, you know, very, very, very important to me and my family.
Mm.
And as you said, it is a matter of life and death.
Mm.
Any decision like this shouldn't be taken lightly. So I just want to say thank you. I think it's you know, fantastic what you're doing in helping people make these decisions. It's not helping people, but just educating them. I mean, from your experience, when you don't have any agenda, but what's your experience in an IT environment for many years? So, you know, you've absolutely helped me and my family with closure. So I just want to say, thank you very much, Patrick.
You're very welcome, and I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to come onto our podcast and share your story with our listeners. I can't thank you enough for that, because, you know, it has been a very difficult time for you in the last few months, and I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day whilst you're probably still going through the grief process, because we're really recording this interview just a few weeks, you know, after your father passed away. So I do really appreciate you taking time out of your day and then coming on to the podcast. So thank you, Adam. For our listeners, check out our Your Questions Answered section as well. We also just opened a membership for families in intensive care, intensivecaresupport.org. You can check that out on our website. If you want to get one-on-one consulting and advocacy, check out the options on our website. And again, thank you, Adam, for coming onto this podcast. Have a good rest of the day.
Okay, thank you, Patrick.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Bye.